So now we've talked about thrombolysis, should we talk a bit about thrombectomy? Because I suppose quite a lot of people probably haven't had many cases that they've kind of referred for thrombectomy or been involved in thrombectomy, even though it has been around for a while now. So can you talk us through the types of patients that you see that you might kind of consider thrombectomy in?
Yeah, absolutely. So clinically, for thrombectomy, we have to think that people are having a reasonably major stroke. And that would generally be that their stroke is severe enough that they have an NIH score of 6 or more. So kind of going through that assessment, if the NIH is below 6, then generally we don't consider those people for thrombectomy. So the stroke has to be severe enough to justify the resource intervention, if that in a kind of health economics way. And people with bigger strokes do better with thrombectomy anyway. So they have to have a stroke with an NIH score of 6 or more. They also have to have a visible clot in one of the big arteries within the brain that are amenable to either having an aspiration catheter where they kind of try and suck the clot out, or a stent retriever where a stent's deployed to try and trap the clot and pull it out. Now, for an anterior circulation stroke, so that's obviously something that's come up through your internal carotid arteries and then to your middle cerebral artery, up to the second division of your middle cerebral artery, so we call it an M2 segment. That's as far as they can go in terms of access to where the clot is. So we can't get right the way up to the tiny branch vessels from your middle cerebral artery. So it has to be kind of proximal. So if it's at the end of your ICA or up to your M2 branch of your middle cerebral artery, then we can get that clot out. And then for posterior circulation, so that's vertebrobasilar system, vertebral arteries that then form your basilar, we can only really get up to the top of the basilar. So at the top of your basilar, you then form your PCAs, which are your posterior cerebral arteries. Can't really get into the PCAs, but we can get to the basilar. And the way that we would diagnose that is with an angiogram. So when we see people acutely with stroke, where we're considering hyperacute intervention, we'll do a CT head and a CT angiogram at the same time, which means that we can illuminate the vasculature and see if there's a visible clot that might be amenable to being pulled out. So that's kind of how we investigate it. And then they have to have an NIH score of 6 or more. In terms of who actually would be eligible for it, irrespective of stroke, in stroke, we tend to look at something called modified Rankin score as to how functional somebody is in day-to-day life from 0 to 6. 6 is dead, 0 is fully independent. And that's because a lot of trial data in stroke uses that as a measure of functional outcome after interventions. So if you are able to manage your own affairs without assistance at home, that would give you a ranking score of kind of 2 or less. And you have to be that good, so to speak, to be able to get a thrombectomy. And that's just kind of, again, economics resource benefit from these sorts of interventions. So you have to have an MRS of 2 or less. You have to have an NIH score of 6 from a stroke perspective, and you have to have a visible clot within the blood vessels in the brain. So that's the sort of base level of who it would be that would get a thrombectomy. At that point, you then start going into the finer questions of, well, what time are we at in terms of the onset of symptoms versus where we are now with someone with a visible clot in the large arteries in the brain? It used to be that for an anterior circulation stroke, we would do it up to 6 hours. Now that's now changed since April with the new national guidance. And again, that's based on a variety of trial data, which suggests that there are people that do get significant benefit from later and longer window intervention. Things like Extend was a trial, which I spoke about earlier. So the national guidance is you could consider thrombectomy for a major anterior circulation stroke up to 24 hours after the
All
onset
right.
of symptoms,
Wow.
as long as they've not got very significant ischemic damage on the brain scan, or clearly that they've infarcted. And that then comes down to shades of grey on a CT scan that we look at. So we, without kind of getting too technical about it, people can look this up. We look at something called an ASPECT score, which is from Canada. It's the Alberta Stroke Program CT score, which basically gives you a score from 0 to 10, looking at the volume of ischemia or damage that you can already see on a plain CT scan. a 10 is a normal healthy brain, and you lose points for different sections of brain that have got ischemic change in, where 0 is, you know, everything is already infarcted and there's nothing to save. So we're in the process of trying to work practically according to those guidelines, because realistically, our current model and service couldn't deliver that with the way that we are set up to be giving people thrombectomies up to 24 hours,
yeah,
just because of the volume we see, ambulance service, number of radiologists that we've got, et cetera, et cetera. It's not possible. So, so our local, I suppose, interpretation of that guideline is we're realistically using about 12 hours at this point in time for an anterior circulation stroke, really, because there are only going to be select cases, I think, of people that would benefit beyond that time frame anyway. And at that, you're talking about really young people there who've got otherwise normal healthy vessels with a good kind of backup collateral blood supply, so that the threatened area has still got some blood supply, even though its main original blood supply is actually blocked. So for thrombectomy, yeah, we're locally for anterior circulation, we're going up to 12 hours really. And I would say beyond that traditional 6 hour period, we'd probably be using advanced imaging to give us a bit of an idea about that core and penumbra, to see exactly what there is there to save. So as a take home, yes, the windows for that have gone up dramatically from where they were before.
No, that's really interesting, because I hadn't realised that, because yes, I still thought it was kind of 6 hours.
Yeah, it's certainly changed an awful lot.
Yeah.
And particularly that probably applies more so for things like wake up stroke, which we kind of mentioned briefly, but not quite sort of touched that much upon. And obviously the traditional view was that, well, if you woke up with your stroke symptoms, it's kind of, well, a bit of aspirin and see what happens. But we know that we can actually make these people significantly better, because we don't really know when the stroke actually started when people wake up. And studies would suggest that actually it's probably more likely that it occurred closer to waking than actually kind of closer than going to bed, just through natural kind of hormonal variations and physiological mechanisms of blood pressure, etc. So I'm sort of digressing a little bit. And
no, let's talk about the wake-up strokes now. It seems like a good time to talk about them.
Okay, so wake-up stroke is obviously this concept that is really starting to emerge, and there was a trial in London a number of years ago called Wake Up, where they used MRI to decide whether people may be suitable for interventions like thrombolysis, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at an MRI scan, it probably looks a bit like double dutch really, but it gives us various different sequences that give you different information. And essentially in stroke, my take on it as a non-radiologist, and they might be kind of swiveling in the chairs with me explaining it this way, but the way that MRI gives us images about ischemia in stroke is all to do with the way that the magnet spins water molecules within brain cells. And water molecules will spin in a different way in damaged brain tissue to non-damaged brain tissue. And that gives us a set of images. And what we tend to look at is something called diffusion-weighted imaging, which looks like a really kind of fuzzy brain picture, but stroke looks like bright white dots or white patches. And we tend to see those changes almost immediately in people with ischemic stroke, but usually after a few minutes. So if someone's having a stroke, within 5 or 10 minutes, we'll probably start seeing changes on these DWI sequences. Mm-hmm. Now, there is another set of sequences on an MRI called FLAIR, which stands for fluid attenuation inversion recovery, I think, which we know you don't get changes in ischemic stroke on those sequences till much later. I think probably somewhere between 4 and 5 hours, which is really quite convenient based on some of the timeframes that we've discussed earlier on. So let's say, for example, you've got someone that comes in with, you know, right face, arm and leg weakness on waking. They were fine when they went to bed. They went for a pee at 1 o'clock in the morning and they were okay. And then they woke up at 7 a.m. with symptoms, and it's now 9 a.m., for example. You know, by using an MRI, if they've got changes on those DWI sequences, but they don't on flare, then that suggests that we're probably within a window where giving them clot busting drugs may help and not cause significant harm, which was the outcome of the results from that wake up trial. So we use MRI a lot in people with wake up strokes to try and decide who it is that may or may not be suitable for treatment, that traditionally we might have just said, well, hard luck, it's happened at some point in the night, we don't know. So just because they've woken up with the symptoms doesn't mean that we can't do anything.
Is that the same for thrombolysis and thrombectomy then? So...
Yeah. The imaging is, the way that we kind of coordinate the imaging is probably slightly different depending on where you work. But yes, you know, let's say, for example, you came in with what looked like quite a major stroke and you had an MRI that had that pattern of mismatch and then had an angiogram which showed a clot, they'd be a candidate for thrombolysis and a thrombectomy.
Yeah.
Equally, there might be some people that present with a wake-up stroke and the CT scan looks okay and they have an angiogram which shows a big clot. They might just go directly for consideration of thrombectomy without even doing an MRI if they're having a stroke like that. Sometimes we use CT almost as a screening tool, which goes against some of the best practice guidelines of double imaging. But let's say, for example, someone comes in and it looks like they're having a total anterior circulation stroke and it's a wake up and they look like they were in yesterday's clothes, which makes you immediately think, well, actually, this probably did happen some time ago, rather than in the pajamas kind of thing. I'd probably just take them for a CT scan first because all of the clinical picture looks like this might have happened a while ago, and we can avoid the issues with MRI, such as consent, metallic implants, foreign bodies, and also the time it actually takes to do the scan. So it will generally take about 15 minutes to do a quick stroke protocol scan for an MRI. CT scan, 30, 40 seconds, it's really quick. So we might use CT almost as a screener at that point, because if it shows that they've got an established infarction, there is no point going to MRI in that point anyway.
You're not going to go any further down that path. So
yeah. And different stroke physicians will do things differently. And being honest, we'll probably go through different phases of the way that we do things. And I went through a phase where I was just doing MRI straight away for people with wake up stroke. And then we had a few cases where they had a lot of established damage already. And then I started doing a bit more CT, particularly for the bigger strokes, just to see whether they're, you know, you're just trying to think about what the right thing to do is for the person in front of you. So it does tend to vary. But just because they've woken up, it doesn't mean that they're not a candidate for everything that we would do just because we knew an onset time.
Yeah. And in general, because obviously thrombectomies are at kind of tertiary neuroscience centres, you thrombolyse locally and transfer for thrombectomy for those patients who are eligible.
So within the stroke world, we call it drip and chip.
Yeah.
We obviously give the alteplase is given a dose of 0.9 milligrams per kilo as the total dose. And we give 10% of the total dose as a bolus over a minute. And then the remaining goes over an infusion by an hour. So usually what will happen is someone comes in with a big stroke. We take them for a CT and a CT angiogram. We see that they've got what's called a large vessel occlusion, which is that clot that we can see. We'll thrombolize them, and often the infusion has pretty much just started going when the paramedic crew then come to take them to the tertiary center, and they'll go with that infusion running in the ambulance.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. And so we've talked about kind of thrombectomy for and timelines for anterior strokes. And what about, because we've kind of touched a little bit on kind of basal artery and where you can get up to, what's the timeline for that for thrombectomy?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of sort of misconceptions and confusion around this, and obviously basilar strokes are the most severe because they are the blood vessels that supply your brainstem, which is all of your autonomic function, and it's a devastating stroke. What we generally know now is that realistically thrombectomy will be of benefit up to 12 hours after the onset of basilar thrombus.
Okay.
There were some trials. There was a trial called Basics, which I think really didn't show any objective benefit of thrombectomy versus thrombolysis in people with these sorts of strokes. And actually, if you're getting towards a later window in these people, we tend to do, again, like before, it's about advanced imaging, either MRI or CTP or MRP to look at exactly what damage is done versus what the clinical picture is like. So if somebody is GCS3 and intubated, but they only have a small infarct on the current scan, then they probably would be a good candidate for intervening. Whereas if they're GCS3 and their whole pons and midbrain is already infarcted, there's not going to be much benefit from doing that. And tragically, then you're in a palliative situation. So 12 hours, you know, for us, the way that we work locally, it's reasonably straightforward because it's pretty much kind of 12 hours and 12 hours realistically. Yeah. But the national guidelines for posterior is 12 hours for vertebrae basilar thrombus.
Okay, so that's come down from the previous thought.
And realistically, based on a lot of that trial data, which suggested that there was very limited benefit in some cases for giving people thrombectomy anyway.
Brilliant. That's been really useful. So thanks so much again, Chris. And as always, our codecasts are available at iTunes and on our website, which is www.aeme.org.uk.